Chris. How are you doing today? Good?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for jumping on. I know what's a very busy schedule that you have already anyway. So
my pleasure.
Thanks for making the time. Firstly, I'm a little bit of a background story. So just for anyone that's not aware, I think obviously because your career has been, it is spanned over a number of years now, a number of bands. But the first time I actually kind of became aware of you was when you were working at Tommy Lee's Atrium Studios. Was one of the first time I think he was doing a few bits himself, and I think you'd done, is it Breaker Box? I think you'd done there
yeah,
as
I,
well.
Yeah, I did a band. I did two or three songs with Breaker Box at the Atrium.
Yeah, and I saw like the behind the scenes, and that was like, I was like, who's this guy? And obviously, then I think Tommy then started to put up his own stuff. But that was, I mean, that was an incredible studio. Anyway, is that still going?
No, he sold that place. I'm trying to think, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. But yeah, that was an incredible spot. I remember when he bought that house, and it was always his dream to be able to buy or to have like a real legitimate studio in his house. And so he bought that house with the pure focus of, I need a house that can house a commercial quality studio. And so I remember when he bought that house, I think before he actually bought it, he showed me the listing. He's like, can we put a studio in here? And I'm like, absolutely. It had like a 16 car, like underground garage and the whole thing. And so when he bought that house, I project managed the studio build there. So that became a little bit of my kind of home base for a while when the Chop Shop closed down. So that was an awesome spot.
Yeah, I remember just seeing, I think obviously from my point of view, being the other side of the pond and not going over as much as I'd like to, but I think seeing all the photos, the videos, but because that had the SSL desk in it, didn't it?
Yep.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, which was an absolute piece of gear.
Oh man, that was so good. I don't know who he sold that to, but I think he ended up selling that as well when he sold the house. The console went to somebody else, but yeah, that console has a whole story. That it's funny, I shot a YouTube video and I never put it out because I was like, got all insecure. It was like before I was doing live streams, and I'm like, this is crap, I'm not putting it out. But I did record a YouTube video of me telling the story of that console.
Nice.
And it's got a really unique story. Maybe one day I'll actually get the balls to put it out.
nice. Yeah, it's always one of those things with desks. I think it's there's always so much history. I think obviously the Foos, obviously when they moved into Studio 66, they obviously had theirs where did they get that?
Boston. Sound City.
Sound City, of course it was.
Yeah.
And obviously Dave done that whole documentary. But I think for someone, you know, who isn't aware, like that is, you know, it's the heartbeat. I mean, obviously you can mix in the box and you can do other things, but I think when you've got such a great console in front of you, it's great. And that album that you done for us was on an old Neve console, and that was one of the reasons why I did that video.
Interesting.
I think they used it on one of the Queen albums. I wasn't too sure. I come up with the guy who owned the place said, but it was used on one of the Queen albums. I was like, I've got,
wow.
If there's only one thing that I can do to say that I've run it through a Neve, at some point, all the pots were, you know, kind of, you had to work with it and warm it up and drive it a little bit, but it was always so much fun kind of working with that. But that was obviously, you know, kind of how I became aware of you. And then ultimately through the years, kind of keeping in touch with what you were doing and the bands you're working with. And I think what I've always seen is when I first became aware of your work, and ultimately over the years, your production style, or at least kind of how you're mixing things, you know, I think has evolved, especially with the advancements in technology. What has that kind of been like for you? Like, is that something that you've kind of been conscious of to kind of keep progressing, or is it just an evolved naturally?
Both, to be honest with you. It's something I can't actually turn off my constant, incessant need to improve or figure out better ways to do things. I'm a big believer in not always practice what I preach, but I believe that, you know, like the workflow and getting especially with mixing, getting the workflow to be as efficient as possible so that you've got a limited amount of bandwidth to focus, and you're focusing that on the stuff that's really important and the stuff that really makes a difference. And so I would say the thing that I think, obviously, I'd like to believe we all improve our skills and our ears get better and we get more in tune and We have more practice and preparation time under our belt, so we kind of know what works and what doesn't. But in addition to all of that, the thing that has really, I think, helped me evolve is just being able to focus on the things that really matter. And I don't want to say discard the things that don't, because it all matters, but to compartmentalize the things that maybe don't matter as much and figure out ways to kind of quickly get those out of the way or get them taken care of when I'm doing mixed prep, or leave time and compartmentalize, like, okay, I'm going to get this mix 95% the way there, to where if the artist is like, hey, we got to move on this, like it has to be at mastering in an hour, I'd be good to go. But then give myself another hour to like really tweak out. And sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes I revert back to the thing I did at 95%. And I'm like, no, this is where it needs to be. It was actually 99%. It wasn't 95. It was 99. I thought I could squeeze an extra 5% out, but I was wrong. But I used to like not tackle. I'd get hung up in the details early on in a mix, to where I would be sometimes 6, 7, 8 hours into a mix and be like, this sucks. Like, this is no good. And not to turn this into a therapy session, but I used to make like a bunch of bullshit excuses as to like why that was a good thing. Yeah. I'll be like, well, I'm trying, I'm experimenting, I'm going down, different paths to find the right one. I'm like, no, this is bullshit. I was totally being self-indulgent and focusing on little things that I thought were super important. Meanwhile, it was probably all subconsciously, because there are so many question marks, and it can be very, the insecurity like runs deep when you're mixing and you're like, is this any good? Am I doing the right thing? Is this working? Is it not working? And so I think early on, and I think a lot of, aspiring mixers get stuck in this, where they'll trick themselves into thinking they're doing something important. And meanwhile, it's like, I've said this before, like it's amazing how many people ask me about mix bus stuff. They're like, what's the attack setting on your mix bus? And I'm like, man, you're like, and some of them I'll even see their mixes, or I'll do mentor calls with people where we're working through and doing some mix training and stuff like that. And the thing that they're really focused on, I'm like, you shouldn't worry about that until 80% of the other stuff is done. But that will be the thing they're fixating on, because, a variety of reasons. But like I said, I think, we've all got insecurities, and with mixing, there's so many variables. It's hard not to be insecure, and it's really hard to get to a point where you're confident and you can make those decisions and then move on.
Well, I think it all comes from experience, really, doesn't it? I think it's putting yourself out there, I think, is the first thing. And also, when you're, as you would know, when you're mixing solo, you've only got your own opinion to go by. You've only got your own ears. I think it's very different, as we all know, mixing with the band in the room or someone else, and you've got that constant feedback straight away by changes or movements. And I think it's easy when you are in that mindset to procrastinate on something, to sit there and really just spend so much time on, like you said, something that you think is really worthwhile. But a lot of that, really, that kind of waste of time and that efficiency is really just down to, I think, from my point of view, the experience, and also just being honest with yourself. If something's shit, it's shit, and just move on from it. But yeah, like you said, especially from your point of view, it's a trap that everyone falls in, no matter, if you're mixing Green Day or mixing, the bands that you first known around the corner from you in the, in the garage. But
yeah,
it's the same mistakes.
It's the same thing. And it's interesting. You made an interesting point that kind of ties into the comment about the consoles. There was I got into the studio business as the transition into Pro Tools was happening. It was like right in the thick of it. So I still made a couple of records on tape, and I worked on DA88s and stuff like that before everything was always Pro Tools, but pretty quickly it became Pro Tools centric. Yeah. And then there was like the conversation of like, oh, well, you can't mix in the box though. You can track into Pro Tools but you can't mix in the box. You got to go to a console. The thing that I will say, and this is kind of one of those, forget about analog, digital, SSL, Pro Tools, like whatever. The fact of having to mix in a studio with a console used to be your only option, would force the band to have to be there with you and yeah. would force the producer to make some decisions and to say, do we like this? Yes or no? Because at the end of today, we need to have a mix done. And if you guys want to belabor this another day or two or three or shut it down and come back to it a week later, well, that's going to cost you $2,000 to rent the studio a day and another $150 because we rented the SSLG compressor and the Sontech and all. Like, there were some consequences to not making decisions. Yep. And so everybody was there and everybody was focused. And so I think that's one of the things that, you know, I love where we're at with mixing. I love the technology. I've had a lot of people ask, say, if you could go mix on an SSL, like if cost and studio and all that stuff wasn't an issue, like, would you do it? And I'm like, no, I prefer where I'm at now in terms of mixing in the box. A variety of reasons that we can get into all like the technical minutiae of it. But there are some drawbacks that aren't Sonic. They're just workflow and they're discipline and they're, you know, it's, I'm in the middle of a mixing project right now where, you know, just getting a vocal level, lead vocal level is like a 5-day process because of, you know, like, okay, no, I don't know. It's a little too loud. And it's like, you used to have to make those decisions. So that muscle, that, you know, that's a skill set. Being able to make a decision and make mix notes is a skill set that artists used to have to be sharp if they wanted their say. Producers used to have to be sharp, being able to focus and be able to nitpick those little things that they don't want to have bug them 6 months from now when the record comes out. Just doing infinite recalls wasn't an option, either time, cost, people scheduling, even the gear. I mean, when I worked at the Chop Shop, we had our recall system down, like so slick. And even still, sometimes you would triple check everything. You're like, something just doesn't sound the same. And, or there might have been there was quick, I'm going off on a couple of tangents,
love
but
it,
a quick,
love it.
A quick, I might've told this story before, but we used to use at the Chop Shop, we used to use a delay unit. It was an old Lexicon delay. It was called a Prime Time. And they were so finicky. And they were old and nobody would fix them. I think there was one guy in LA who could fix those units, but then I don't know if he retired or if he moved away and quit, whatever it was, we couldn't get them fixed anymore. And so we had a stockpile of these Prime Times. I think we had like 6 or 7. Here's the crazy thing is they would stop working in like mid mix, stop working. They would just start going and like, and you'd be like, okay, that one's down. So we would unplug it and we'd go put it in a pile and we'd grab another one and we'd plug it in and it would work. No problem. The crazy thing is it would just cycle because when we would come back, when we would go through the 7 we had, we would just start the process over. And that one that was buzzing 2 months ago now works. And so, but even something like that, like I remember there was one album, wouldn't have been at the Chop Shop. Maybe it was, no, it wouldn't have been Atrium. I'm trying to think of where it was. There was one album where we did a bunch of mix recalls and there was a compressor that we used pretty heavily. Might've been like on like the drum subgroup, like the parallel drums. And that compressor, we just didn't have anymore. Like it died and couldn't get parts and just didn't have it anymore. And so, you know, when somebody wants to recall the album 4 months later, because, you know, who knows for what reason, because the vocal level or the guitar might need a little more 2K or something. It's kind of like, okay, are you willing to give up the sound that we had on the drums 3 months ago in order to get that one little thing and the guitar frequency better, or is it not worth it? And I can't remember what we ended up doing, but yeah, I like where we're at. The lack of the discipline because there's no friction with recalling a mix. And even for, like I said, you know, the way that I've had to evolve and I've had to really put some self-discipline into my process, because it was easy for me too to be like, especially when I worked at home, I'm not working at home anymore, which is, man, that has been a game changer. I hate that term game changer, but it actually has been a game changer for me because if I want to go home and have dinner with my kids, or if I want to beat traffic, or if I want to go to bed tonight, you know, it's like I have to finish at a certain time. So you start prioritizing, like, you're like, does the decay time of that reverb on the synth patch, does that really matter? Or is the one that just popped up okay? And so you start eliminating a lot of those like little things that I used to spend like 10, 15 minutes tweaking. And now you're like, well, like turn up a reverb. Cool. Done. Go. Yep. Move on.
Yeah, so. No, I get that. I think it's there's a few bits you mentioned that kind of really kind of I think would kind of ring true to a lot of people that have been in those positions, especially with gear. I think, you know, because gear has its own character. You know, you can have, you know, one compressor, you know, a couple of distressors, for instance, and they can sound different than the other. And like you said, when you're doing recall mixes, it's just it's always the challenge. But I think Sometimes that's always the fun part, because something, as you know, something may come up out of, you know, a mistake. You know, and you they go, oh wow, and we've all had that. And I think it's very easy, like you said, to kind of sit there. And you made a really good point as well about the location. As we know, in studios, for instance, you know, there's normally no windows. You know, there's barely a clock on the wall. You get lost, and I think sometimes it's very easy to kind of stay in that space of, oh, we've got plenty of time. You can spend some time on this. And to be really honest, the budgets really aren't there anymore either. You know, So it's the time it takes to do that. So being more efficient, and like you said, having a location. Now, not everyone can have a separate location in their house, yep, you know, to go work from, but even just making that environment feel a little bit different, putting yourself on the clock, you know, creating that atmosphere, I think it is key. And the next thing I want to get into is, because, you know, the bands that you've worked with, you know, when we're talking about some of the most award-winning bands, especially in rock, that, you know, it's I think, well, out of most people, you know, would have loved to have worked with at some point. And one of the bands that I've always been a huge fan of is obviously Nickelback, you know, and the work that you have done, you know, with those guys, I think is, you know, yet again, we'll get into the involvement and your process behind that. I think has been revolutionary, because, you know, that's a band that was very much in this bracket. And now we've, you know, they've really changed their sound. They're really progressing. And that's something that I think a lot of people, you know, have looked at you as like an inspiring kind of mixer, producer, engineer. So it'd be really good to get into that world, because, you know, we've got Daughtry, we've got Avril Lavigne, we've got Rob Zombie, we've got Tommy Lee. But I think for most people would probably be most aware of Nickelback. So Chris, what I'm really interested in is understanding, one, how that call was, how you were originally brought in. You know, that's... You know, it could have been love of hockey. I don't know. it could have been the love of hockey. But, you know, firstly, like, you know, take us back. You know, how were you originally brought in? You know, what was that like, you know, seeing the guys there? And ultimately, what does that process originally look like with your involvement?
So how that started, I mean, it's kind of crazy the path that led to where we're at today. And you kind of mentioned it earlier, Tommy Lee was my conduit to Chad Kroeger. And back in 2004 or 2005, we were doing, at the Chop Shop, Scott Humphrey was producing, a Tommy Lee solo album. I think that was the one that ended up being Tommy Land. And, and I was Scott's engineer at the Chop Shop at the time. And so that, how Tommy was doing that album was each song was kind of a different collaboration with a different established artist, right? And so I'm not sure if Tommy and Chad were buddies before that, or if that's kind of how they kind of became buddies. Nonetheless, Chad came down to LA and spent, I don't know, it felt like about a week, but maybe it wasn't that long. Maybe it was only a few days at the Chop Shop doing a song for Tommy's record. And so at that time, like, Nickelback was big because Silver Side Up had been out for a couple of years, but All the Right Reasons hadn't come out yet. So that was, I mean, that was a, I don't think anybody thought there could be a next level, but there was a next level for them. And so I was a fan of Nickelback. I was a, but even more than that, I was a fan of Chad's work, because at the time he was such a an in-demand, like, you know, collaborator. He was songwriting, doing songwrites with other people and producing other artists. And a lot of the stuff that I was a fan of, you know, he had his hands on. And so he came to L.A. We worked on a song. I was so impressed with just the way that he went about working in the studio. Great guitar player, great singer, great writer. I was just really impressed. And we got along and the session went pretty well. And so when Chad was, I will back up a second. The Chop Shop was one of the coolest studios to this day. It doesn't exist anymore in the way that did, but it was incredible. Anybody who walked in that place was like, this place is awesome. So I had to preface this because beyond the Tommy Lee session, when Chad would come to LA to do co-writes, or if he had to record a little something with an artist who was in town, he would reach out to Scott and say, hey, can I book the studio for the day? And it wasn't really a commercial studio. It was more like a friends and family kind of thing.
Yep.
But Scott would be like, yeah, sure. We're not really busy. Come use the studio for a couple of days. Chris is here. He'll run the session, the whole thing. So for the next year or two, maybe once every, like, I don't know, 3 months, 4 months, Chad would come to LA and I'd spend a day doing whatever session he had going on. And he was all, you know what, something was really that I'll never forget about Chad. There were a lot of sessions where, you know, you'd go in and you'd work a day, you know, we'd work really hard, be really focused and get a lot done. And then like the artist or the producer or whatever would be like, yeah, we're going to go out for dinner. And it was very much, you know, the studio staff, you know, and being kind of like the engineer. Sometimes sometimes in certain sessions, sometimes you kind of lean closer to where you're like, you're a linchpin in the session.
Yep,
and other times you're, I don't want to say a glorified assistant, but you're almost kind of just a commodity with, doesn't matter who's there. Somebody's here running the rig. And, Chad would always invite me out for dinner. And so like, he would have a big artist in town. They would do a vocal overdub or they'd do a co-write. And he's like, hey, we're going to go for dinner. Why don't you come for dinner with us? And I always thought that was really awesome. So I got to know him a little bit outside of just kind of, you know, engineering his sessions, and we got along really well. I kept in touch with him a little bit. I knew All the Right Reasons was coming out because I actually recorded a few little ad lib things that Billy Gibbons did on Rockstar.
Yep.
So they came and did that at the Chop Shop. It was supposed to be a guitar solo. And then Chad started doing show and tell with the rest of the record. I remember hearing All the Right Reasons, like most of it before it came out. I was like, this is incredible.
Yeah.
But anyways, we did a few things. Long story short, I would keep in touch with him. Like when that album came out, I'd shoot him a text and congratulate him. I think, you know, how awesome it was and blah, blah, blah. And he would get back to me. But, you know, once the Chop Shop closed and we kind of lost touch a little bit. And literally out of nowhere, probably 4 or 5 years later, he called me and he's like, hey, what are you busy today? And I think I was at home mixing something. But it wasn't like urgent. And I'm like, I can make myself available. What's up? And he's like, well, I'm working on an Avril Lavigne record. We're down at the record plant. Can you come down and track vocals for us today? And I'm like, sure, I could be there in an hour. And so, literally from, you know, I don't know, probably 2005 or 2006 to like maybe it was 3 or 4 years, but didn't really work with Chad a lot, if any. And just kind of kept in touch with very kind of casual congratulations on an album release kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then out of the blue, it was kind of like, we need an engineer to help finish this Avril Lavigne record. And then that turned into more sessions with them. And then that turned into, we need one more song for the record. And it needs to be like a, you know, kind of a pop punky thing. And then I ended up co-producing that song and kind of pushing that thing forward and getting that done. And then as soon as that album was done, Chad basically said, he's like, hey, we're going to start making a Nickelback record. Do you want to be a part of that? And I said, absolutely. And again, that started off as kind of like more of just kind of engineering, and then that turned into co-production. And then I think on that first album that I did with them, I think I did one mix, and then the next album, I think I did five mixes. And then on the last album, I did all of them except for one. So it just kind of, it kind of evolved. And through the process of making those records with the band, I mean, I love all the guys in the band. Their whole crew, like their management and their tour manager and their road crew, like I've become such good friends with all of them and consider a lot of them kind of like family at this point. I've said this a bunch of, like, if I never make another record with Nickelback, like they'll still be some of my, you know, closest friends and people that I love. But when I go back and think about that, it's like, it spanned over 20 years. Like I said, I met Chad probably 20 years ago, which is crazy to think, but,
I mean, so I was going through the kind of, the back catalog of Nickelback and looking at the credits. Mm-hmm. And that's why I asked the question, because I can literally see your name at the start and obviously then slowly getting bigger and bigger and in more credits, more credits. And I was like, and this is one of those things I think a lot of people can look at that, you know, from a level of jealousy, which is natural to some people. But like you said, hearing that story about the fact that it wasn't, you know, I coined the term an overnight success.
Yeah.
It was something that gets built, and there's a lot of trust involved. You know, like you said, I think Nickelback and especially Chad are in a position where they could probably pick up the call to anyone and probably get them in on the job. And I think even from my point of view, what I love about the work that you've done with them is, as we know, Chad is an unbelievable songwriter. I think that, and that's not even just in his work, the people that he's worked with, you can really tell that he can craft a song to a point where it reaches the masses, but I think it means something individually to each people. But coming from a drummer's perspective, and I know obviously you're a big fan of drums as well.
Yes.
Daniel Adair is, if not one of, probably the last two decades best rock drummers, which I think is unbelievable in the fact that one, you know, yet again, obviously I think he got kind of pulled in from Three Doors Down, yet again, not a small gig at all.
Yeah.
And I think what I love about the way that you've been working with those guys is drums haven't been pushed to the back. In fact, actually, they've been coming probably more to the front, where guitars naturally were a little bit more driven to the front of the mix. And even in the songwriting, I think the drums are now becoming a really big part of that. And I know, obviously, having kind of read, you know, and watched a lot of Daniel, he probably feels like he's probably now an actual member of Nickelback as opposed to as opposed to Iron Hand. I really want to get him on here one day. I'd love to get him on here. But it's something where I think from your work that you've done with him, I think what I'm hearing now is there's a lot more strings. There is a lot more instrumentation going into it as opposed to it just being, and of course there are the songs that are just the hard hitting rock songs, which are needed. But from your point of view, especially now with your much more heavier involvement with that band, what's it like from a kind of a songwriting and a production point of view when you're working with probably opinions? Do you have a finished song and the guys just playing it? What does that look like when you're involved with, you know, four incredible musicians in their own right?
Yeah, I mean, it varies based on the song and just based off the situation. So like the very first record that I did with them, which ended up being the album No Fixed Address.
Yeah.
The reason it was called that is we bounced around to different locations. Pretty much, I've heard Chad eloquently describe the situation, and I'm not going to say it as good as he can, but he basically said, he's like, we would go rent a house and we would set up a makeshift studio. And he's like, and we would drain every ounce of creative energy out of it. And then we would pack up and move to another house. And that's literally what it was. But what was really cool about that is, I think there was two or three of them that we went to Maui. Nice. And so when we're going on, like, it's kind of, you know, that's a long commute. So everybody got together and went out there. When we're in LA or we're in Vancouver, sometimes it's more just kind of me and Chad at the beginning where he'll have a guitar idea or a vocal idea, and then we build it out. And then the other guys, if, you know, we start sending out kind of, here's what we did, you know, last week or today or whatever. And then somebody will get excited and be like, that's awesome. I'm going to come in and let's start working this stuff out. So it varies. A lot of it, obviously, you know, Chad's just such a prolific songwriter. A lot of it kind of starts with him. And then we'll start building it out to see is there something here?
Yeah.
And sometimes you gotta go down the road a little bit with, you know, finishing a verse and a chorus and kind of producing it up and being like, is this as good as we thought when we heard, you know, the acoustic guitar and the vocal in the back of the room?
Yeah.
A lot of the time it is, but you know, sometimes it's not. And so we take our time and we really kind of flush everything out and make sure every little thing's as good as it can be. And that takes time. And I think everybody's got a different threshold for how long they can be in the room for that process.
Yeah.
And it's also nice when you can have, you know, for instance, like when I go to record bass with Mike, for a lot of the songs, he hasn't been sitting in the room for days on end, agonizing over like a lyric or something like that. So when he comes in, he's got a really fresh perspective.
Fresh.
Yeah. And he'll be like, yeah, that part there. He's like, are we sold on all this stuff? Or is like, are we still tweaking this thing? And, we're tweaking that. And I'll pull up my laptop, make a little note. We need to tweak that. But no, it's nice having that. And everybody in that band, in my opinion, has a very, not different musical taste, but everybody has like a little something different. So their perspective is different. And even like with Daniel, like, you know, sometimes I think he gets frustrated because sometimes by the time he gets to dig in on his thing, the song has been so kind of flushed out. It's like, you know, you got the handcuffs on a little bit.
Yeah.
But that's why one of the reasons he's so amazing is he can kind of do anything great. So there are songs where it's like, sorry, dude, we got another four on the floor with, you know, eighths on the hi-hat. And we just, but he'll, instead of being like, well, I need to overplay this one or whatever, I need to come up with something different. I think he, what makes him so amazing is he can take something that maybe is a simple part and make it sound incredible and make it feel exciting. Yeah. And, I think some other drummers need kind of a little flash in order to make it really impactful. And he does it. Like, he's capable of doing all of that better than anybody else as well. But when it comes to kind of the simple straight ahead beats, it's like the way he plays them and how he executes them and the way the drums sound, is the thing that to me, that makes that separates a good drummer from a great drummer is when it's kind of like,
exactly,
when you can execute all the parts, you're a good drummer. When you can take the simple part and like level it up because of how you're playing it.
Yeah.
That's the great. Those are the great drummers. Tommy Lee, same thing.
Well, like, that's exactly what I was going to say. Both being massive Motley Crue fans.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the stuff that he plays is intricate, but it's got a voicing. You know, you can put Tommy Lee in another band and you know that's Tommy Lee playing the drums.
Oh, yeah.
Which has happened a number of times. And I think even the same thing with Daniel. I know he's obviously done the Martone stuff and a few other things before. You can just listen and you go, that's Daniel 100%. Same thing with, I mean, one of my favorite drummers, Josh Fries.
Josh is amazing.
One of the most prolific session players, you know, you would know. But I went through his catalog a little while ago. And I was like, I remember that song. I love that song. I mean, I started to realize that all of my world came back in on itself. I was like, oh, every band that I liked listening to in the late 90s, early 2000s had Josh on. Because you know, and I think, you know, kind of bringing it back to, you know, when you are in a band and you're producing a band, I think it's, you know, it's also a job trying to kind of extract as much as the essence of the individual members to make the sum of the parts stronger as possible. Because as you would know, you know, it's you may have one player stronger than the other, or, you know, not a Nickelback sense, but some bands that might come through. And when you're looking at the mix itself and you maybe are not producing, but you get it, you go, maybe there's some points here. I can maybe tell who's a little bit stronger, who maybe could have needed some work. But it's all for the greater sum of the parts, isn't it? It's all to, you know, you know what you want, you play for the song.
Yeah, everything's got to be, in service of making this, not only the song, but then like the record, the recording, right? That, yeah. As great as it can be. And maybe there have been times where I maybe haven't been, you know, the most gentle with really hammering that fact home with clients that I work with. But at the end of the day, it's kind of like, this isn't about the guitar player. This isn't about the drummer. Yeah. This isn't about anybody, even the singer. A lot of the time, even though they're the voice and maybe they wrote the lyrics and it really means a lot to them, it's even kind of, to me as a producer, not even about them per se. It's about the song and it's about the record. And yeah. So, you know, everything has to kind of live and die with that, at least in my eyes. I mean, I know like some other people might disagree with me, or I think there's a way to achieve that with also then making everybody kind of have their identity or their importance of what they wanted to bring to it. But if it doesn't serve the song or the record, it's kind of on the chopping block, per se.
Exactly. It's serving your own purpose, isn't it? I think it's like, I've done it. We've all done it, overpaid on things. Oh. Back now, and we go, oh, God. I mean, the album that you mixed for us, I was like, oh, I've definitely overplayed that part. But I've had some people go, I love your drums on that. But I'm like, oh, yeah, but it's all, you know. And you made a really good point earlier, which I think is great. And I want to kind of dig into that a bit more. And you mentioned about originally at the start of this, you were like, you really love where we are right now with kind of technology and the way that the production mixing is working. But do you find sometimes, especially you mentioned as well, you know, if there's a songwriter, for instance, as you mentioned, Chad, and they'd send the stems, the ideas over, and those guys might have their own rigs and record the bits over and send it over, you know, drop mixes out. But do you think now that there's an element that someone, for instance, if they're a guitar player or a singer-songwriter, that they might then go, oh, I can just get the drums programmed on this and I can just have something. And then the more and more that happens, that then just becomes the song. And then by the time the actual musicians get on board with it, that they probably don't have the space to put their own touch on. Do you think that that's also a bit of a kind of a bad part of where we are right now as well?
Yeah, it definitely can be. And again, it's so, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because there's a lot of scenarios where like that process actually facilitates what makes that record great. I've been involved with a lot of, probably more on the mixing side, because if I'm involved in the production, I try to correct this before we get to that point. Yeah. But yeah, I get a lot of sessions, you know, that to mix where you can tell that, you know, maybe the guitars were like this from the songwriting demo and they didn't want to go back and re-record them. And so they tried to edit them and maybe reamp them. And it's like, there's something not right. Or the same thing with like you said, the drums are like, yeah, we programmed drums. Then we got to the end and we thought it sounded great. So we're like, why bother? I think ultimately less about like, is programming and, you know, let's say the more, you know, bricklaying approach of production, less about whether or not that's good or bad, and more about the fact that it's the decision of whether or not it's good or not is kind of made just based off of, you know, path of least resistance. What's the cheapest? What's the fastest? What's the, you know, I think because I there have been songs that we've done. When I say we, just me and the artists that I work with, there's been songs that we've done where you go and you're like, okay, now we're tracking the record. And so you go replay the guitars. You're like, they're not as good. There's something about the other ones that aren't just better. And yeah, maybe they're not as tight. Maybe the sound isn't quite as good, but like there's something to that. Or you get to the end and you're like, you know what? The program drums just have a thing to it. So let's just overdub cymbals because the cymbals sound a little fake and you're leaving everything else. And so there are scenarios where you get to the same result, but you got there on purpose and you got there with thought and you got there not as because you're cutting corners or because you're cheaping out or whatever. You're getting to that result because it's what was best for the record. I think the thing that you're referring to is very much almost just, and I'm not in rooms of other people's sessions, so I can't say what they're doing, but I would have to guess, because I have been privy to enough of the conversations of, yes, it's kind of like, what's it going to cost to record, you know, have Josh Freese come and play drums on this? And how long is it going to take?
Yeah.
And people are like, nah, we're good.
Yeah.
And so not only are we not leaving space for the musicians, but we're also not leaving space for the possibility and the potential of having something be a little unique or having something not sound the same. I think ultimately the thing that bugs me the most about it is just how homogenized everything's kind of becoming. And I think that leads to it. When it just becomes acceptable to not at least consider that maybe re-recording the guitars would be better, or maybe having a live drummer on would be better. Yeah, it's a thing. I just don't know, you know, other than, you know, you have to kind of just do both and see what works. I mean, I do miss the days of, I sound like an old guy, but you know, I do miss the days of like starting with the band.
Yep.
And then being like, okay, we worked everything out, pre-production, we tracked the band live off the floor. Okay, if you get to the end and you got to go and, you know, punch in the drums and re-record the drums, or, you know, even program the drums, yep, you know, okay, that's okay. But at least you're like, you've heard it. At least you went down that road. At least you gave the session space to and the possibility for getting something great, yeah, and unique, right, and different. And that's something I say a lot, is like, even just the fact of miking up a guitar cabinet or a drum kit, even at the chop shop, we used to leave a drum kit mic'd up. It was the same drum kit, same microphones. I'd have all the preamp settings the same. A drummer, Tommy Lee, would come in and play, and it would sound a certain way. And then a week later, we would have a session with another band, and even that, though everything was the exact same, it would sound a little bit different.
Yeah.
And so even that little bit of difference, if you times that across the entire process, adds up. Same with the amps. We had amps in-house. A lot of those amps were all, I set the mics once every 3 months. I would set up the mics and, you know, obviously we would blend and we would, yeah, change stuff. But we could have two bands come in, and with the exact same rig, obviously the songs are different, and the singers are different, and the players are different, but it's just going to sound inherently different just because of just like the nature of what it is. Whereas if you're using drum samplers all the time, it's going to sound exactly the same. Exactly the same, unless you do something different. Or even as much as I love guitar amp modeler, same thing. It's like, yep, that preset is going to sound the exact same every day. That's also what I love about them. But it's a, yeah, double-edged sword, right? Yes. So it's also the thing of like, yeah, with my drum samplers, I never have to worry about that snare drum that I love being like, fuck, why isn't the tuning working today? And it's because it got really cold at night, and now it's really hot during the day, and now that drum kit sounds different. But all these little variabilities lead to things sounding unique, even, yeah, if it's just a little bit unique, which I think we are missing that in, yeah, modern music production.
It's the kind of cookie cutter approach, I think, because it's like you said, it's the path of least resistance, but not using that in a way that gives you more time to use some space to maybe play around some things. Like you said, it's, yeah, very easy, especially in some studios that you go in there where it's like, hey, look, like you said, the drums get set up. That's good to go. We use this guitar cab. This is a guitar I prefer to use. You know, bass runs through this. We've got it through a DI, but we've got an Ampeg sat there. Everything's done. And before you even know it, you know, there's already samples on the drums. There's no room for playing around. But that kind of brings us back to the point of budgets and time. And also, I think when I think about it now, I do think about the use of like pre-production work, because I think now it's bands. Not all bands, I don't mean it like that, but I think it's very easy for bands just to jump in a studio straight away. But some bands prefer, you know, the, like you mentioned, the kind of building block style of songwriting. You know, there was one Rick Rubin, wasn't really a quote, but it was an element when he was working with Linkin Park on that, the album they had after Meteora, that one when they kind of changed their sound a little bit more.
Yep.
And they kind of broke down their production. He was like, yeah, you don't produce like, you know, you don't produce and songwrite like a band. You produce like a hip hop, you know, team, you know, production team. And that attributes to the sound that you have. So throw that out the window. If you want to sound different, let's do it different. And I think
yeah.
you know, that approach really bit. Yeah. Yeah. If you want to sound different, like you said, give yourselves the opportunity to do something a little bit different. You know, use technology, you know, to open up doors.
Yeah. Yeah, and it can facilitate the process as opposed to kind of dictating the process. Yeah. And you know what? That's an interesting. I've never heard that Rick Rubin quote or saying or you know whatever you know however he phrased it, but it's actually very true. It's like I haven't done a lot of hip hop, but you know, in rock the same thing happens. It's kind of like instead of in hip hop being like you got a beat guy. And you're like, okay, let's play a beat. And once I hear a beat we like, okay, we'll start working on that. The same thing, it's the exact same thing, but it's guitar riffs or it's, you know, and so, you know, you'll sit down in a studio at the beginning of a session and everybody's got a Pro Tools rig and everybody will pull up their demos where it will be a really great sounding guitar riff on really great sounding programmed drums. And really awesome sounding program bass and everything's quantized and everything's tight. And it was like, you just start sifting through ideas. You're like, ooh, I like that one. Let's finish that one. And then it's just a matter of, it's almost like you just kind of then work on top of that as opposed to, cause it sounds amazing. Why are we going to go back and re-record it? Cause it sounds so incredible. Well, then the other thing that happens as you're writing the song, you get used to that drum sample and all of a sudden you're like, okay, let's make our own sample, like something. I don't know if this is true or not, but somebody told me, I think it's true. Somebody told me, I don't know if it was Dr. Dre or maybe it was Timbaland, but one of the like those really like prolific hip hop guys, producers, they would use existing samples to produce the song fast. But then it was something where they're like, we have to go and replace every one of those stock sounds.
Yeah.
With something that we've created. So if there was a little, if there was a shaker loop, use the one from the MPC. That's fine. But before this thing goes out the door, we're redoing that shaker with a live shaker, or we're going to make our own loop out of this other thing that we pulled off of a record, and we're going to time stretch it and chop it up. Like everything had to be replaced to where it wasn't from a sample library, or it wasn't from an album they did, you know, 3 months ago or whatever. And so everything was unique. That doesn't happen anymore, especially with rock music, where it's like, even if something as simple as a snare sample, it's kind of like, okay, let's make our own snare sample. It's like, no, that one from Easy Drummer sounds great. Yeah. Why are we going to replace it? And it's hard to argue with because it does sound good. You're like, what else does it need? I don't know. It sounds awesome.
Yeah.
But
very true. Yeah, very true. And I think it's also, like you said, it's tough because I think we're going back to the original point, like being a mixer, you can just spend hours and hours on something that just isn't important or you think is important. Like, oh yeah, to be fair, I don't want to use that slate, you know, the slate drums on that one, you know, the SSD, you know, snare drum, for instance. I'd prefer to, you know, let's get some different snare drums and let's start sampling our own stuff. And you think, you know, but it sounds fine. You know, we're spending, I think it's very easy to, you know, to get caught in that kind of rabbit hole of trying to force things to happen. Yeah, you know, if it sounds okay, then it sounds okay. If it sounds great, then brilliant, then we've saved ourselves time and we can use time somewhere else. And I think, like you said, now I'm a big believer in technology. Like, don't get me wrong, I think, you know, bands that go back and, you know, same thing as yourself, obviously not the career side of things, but I started originally working on tape and analog gears, how I did my original degree and when I really got into it. And I'm glad that I was at that starting point where it was about mic technique. It was about, you know, what outboard gear you're running it into, you know, how much you boost it. But I think what I've learned now about technology is it really is just there for efficiency. And also to give you more ideas without, I mean, you know, the plugin libraries now, I mean,
crazy.
Your kind of lives that you do on YouTube are so insightful. Because, you know, I think it's very easy for people to have, I mean, when I go on, you know, plugins on my Pro Tools, you know, it's just lists and lists and lists. Like, you can spend ages. And for someone like yourself, and I'd implore anyone to watch your videos, because You learn so much about, you know, about what works, what doesn't work, and also an efficient way to throw things in. I mean, you actually, I learned about, you know, folders, you know, on Pro Tools from you. And I was like, I didn't know that. I was just doing subgroups originally and then putting them in there. But, you know, it's all those things. But I think from your point of view, you've always been an advocate for technology. You know, I think you've always said that, you know, mixing the box is where you feel really comfortable and it's efficient now with your workflow.
Yeah.
What would you say has changed, you know, in the last 5 years of your workflow now? Especially being really kind of hot on the pulse of the latest plugins and, you know, amp sims, you know, what is really kind of changing your workflow?
That's a great question, because I feel like I'm glad you said 5 years, because it, you know, somebody might've said 5 months and been like there's such small incremental changes. Like it would be hard to pinpoint that. I mean, there's so much stuff. Like if you looked at a mix I did 5 years ago, like there's going to be a lot of familiarity with that, of what I'm doing today. It's probably just that mix 5 years ago took me 18 hours. And the one that I did today took me like 8 hours. And the one I did today, I'm really confident that it's fucking great.
Yep.
And the one 5 years ago was a little bit more like, ooh, I hope they like it, you know? but, you know, it is a good point. I think I've just become much more aware of what works for me. And you did mention, you know, my YouTube videos, something that I preach a lot, not only on the videos, but, you know, just in private conversations and with, you know, people that I've mentored and assistants that I've had in the past and stuff like that. What works for me might not work for you. I have tendencies. I have strengths. I have weaknesses. I have insecurities. There's things I'm really confident about. That's different for everybody. I just named like five criteria, like points. And if you start kind of tweaking with all those things, even a little bit, you know, it's kind of like a video game, you know, character where it's kind of like you can run fast. If you increase that, well, now you're not as strong. And if you can jump really high, well, now you're not going to live as long. I don't know, whatever. Like, I don't play video games, but you know what I mean? It's kind of the same thing. It's like you start tweaking all these little things and then all of a sudden you come out with a completely different person. So, you know, I try to be very careful to say you should do this, or you have to do this, or this is what, this is the best, or this way. I try to be, obviously I sometimes do, but I try to be careful about not saying that type of stuff and just be like, listen, this is what works for me. But more importantly, less about what I'm doing and like, how did I get here? Because most of where I'm at now, I didn't stumble upon. So when I'm not mixing, if I don't have a client I'm mixing for, I don't just pull up a track and kind of willy-nilly, no, I'm just going to mix a track for fun. I don't do that. I say, what am I going to use this time for? So that way, when I do have a mix to do, I've dealt with some of those, I call them pain points, you know? So when I'm mixing, if a mix that I did yesterday, I had a really hard time with, you know, vocal reverbs. The next time I have a spare 3 or 4 hours, I'm going to be like, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go through all my all the reverbs I have, and I'm going to figure out which one of them just kind of is easier for me to work with. Are there 3 or 4 settings that once I start tweaking those, it's like, oh, that's what I like. And I figure that I try to use that as practice time and experimentation time and figure that stuff out when I'm not in the middle of a mix.
Yeah.
That works for me. I know some people that couldn't do that because that is so boring to them. It's going to be like, I'd rather be like, just not. And so you need to, if that's you, you got to figure out something else so that you don't end up spending 3 hours struggling with a vocal reverb. So I think the biggest thing that's changed for me over the last 5 years is just being so much more aware of needing to implement different processes in order to like get to a point where when I sit down and mix, not only is my session set up in a good way, but I know what my tools are. I can hear in my head what I want it to sound like. And I've already figured out not all the time, yeah, you're still experimenting. It's not, you know, I kind of relate it to like a Hall of Fame baseball player. If you hit 3 out of 10, you're in the Hall of Fame. So it's kind of like,
so true.
When I come across an issue with a mix, like if I'm mixing and I'm like, yeah, you know what? The cymbals, there's just something wrong with the cymbals. And I know in my head that I've got a couple different options that I can do to fix those. If I can be right, like 3 out of 10, like I'm good. Because when you don't get it, the first time, you're kind of like, all right, well, then you move on to the next thing. Then you move on to the next thing and you move on to the next thing. You're like, okay, well, now I got it. But, you know, my goal is to kind of be able to, you know, get better at making that, solving that problem with my first instinct. Yeah. Right. So I'm not having to go through the plugin list. It's kind of like, no. You know what? The Distressor plugin works perfectly for that. Done. Awesome. That worked. Solved the problem. Awesome.
Yeah.
Right. And so I've had to figure out a way to build up to that point and to get there without just mixing 2,000 songs and being unhappy with 1,700 of them.
Yeah, it's not the amount of at-bats you have. It's ultimately the time you have when you're there. Yeah,
yeah. And to make more bad baseball analogies, It's the equivalent of, and I see this happen all the time, and it really confuses me a little bit. And yeah, mixing's not baseball, but it's a skill. It's a skill set. There's a lot of variables. It's not the same every day. It's different music. It's just like, you know, you're pitching against a different pitcher and he might be throwing it a little bit different because he didn't get enough sleep the night before. Like there's all these variables, right? And I find a lot of people just sit down and mix the way what the equivalent of would be of a baseball player just showing up and playing the games.
Yeah. Yeah.
And on Monday after the game, there was no batting practice and there was no strength training and there was no meeting with the manager to figure out what the strategy, like all of that takes place. And so I have figured out for me the equivalence to the strength training, the batting practice, the, you know, strategy, the watching game tape of the pitcher that I'm going to be playing next week. You know, like I have figured out the equivalence for those for my mixing. And there's still works in progress the same way athletes, you know, if they figured out, everybody would win the championship every year. And that's still not figured out. So it's a moving target, but I figured out that like I need these different things that I need to kind of compartmentalize. So that way, when I go to mix, I've got a lot of that shit figured out, at least arming myself with the tools to where, I still get to the end of a day and be like, I don't think this mix is any good. And I might start over the next day. That still happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's happening a lot less. And mixes are coming together a lot quicker to where they're more fun. And I feel more objective and I'm getting better results. There's one other thing I did want to say because I think it really applies. Talking about just kind of like the brick by brick thing and the technology of where we're at and kind of how people are using it. A lot of people are very surprised by how empty my mix templates are. I think everybody thinks that when I import my mix template either into a session or import somebody's session into my mix template, they think my guitar EQs are set. They think my snare drum samples are picked. They think my mix bus settings are the same. They're not. I have the majority of my mix templates don't have like channel strip plugins. They don't have EQ plugins on them. And once everything's in and formatted and all the routing's going where it's going and I'm hearing the mix, I'm hearing the song, then I'll decide, okay, I want SSL channel strips on everything and I'll put them on everything and start going.
Yep.
But I do that on purpose because I don't want everything sounding the same. And I don't want to be like, those guitars sound fine. I want to almost force myself to have to address the guitars. even if they don't need anything, I've had to at least think about it and make that determination, as opposed to just putting them through at all the chains that worked on the last Nickelback song I did. They're going to work on this other thing that I'm doing for this other band that wants to sound like Nickelback. And it's like, I don't do that, number one, so that it doesn't always sound the same. And number two, because most of the time it doesn't anyways. There's always some sort of variable. I mean, I'm doing a project right now where I started one song, mixed it. Everybody loves it. I imported, they want the album to kind of have a consistency. I imported everything into this next song. And I'm like, this is going to be great. I'm going to have this song. I'm going to have this song mixed in an hour. And I'm like, this does not sound good. I'm like, how is that possible? But it does, but it didn't work.
Yeah.
Different tempo, different, different tuning.
Yeah.
The way that the vocal is hitting, it's more staccato and less drawn out. And all these changes are variables that then all of a sudden make some of those other decisions not relevant. So,
yeah, no, that's so true. And I think you mentioned before as well, I think it takes a lot of humility as a person to not be driven by ego and actually turn around and go, yeah, I probably can improve on this. I need to improve on this. I think it's sometimes, you know, as you know, when you mix one track or an album and you go, you know what, I absolutely nailed that. It sounds amazing. You go, that's it. I've done. I've made it. You know, that's it.
Yeah,
I've now learned what I need to learn.
Yeah.
But then also thinking like, well, that did take me quite a long time to mix those guitars in. And yeah, I had a bit of a problem with that reverb channel. And yeah, maybe I should. I think that humility, you know, and from your point of view, in a person in your position to still have that today and wanting to improve and wanting to look at workflow and wanting to look at these areas that can be, yet again, just to make it more efficient for you to do the best mix and produce the best album that you can do. I think, yeah, that takes a lot. And would you say that that's kind of, you know, some key points as we kind of wrap up, kind of advice for those aspiring mixers, you know, to kind of come in, you know, what is the kind of quick kind of points that you've really learned to kind of, you know, over the course of your career?
Yeah, I would say, you know, try to figure out what, again, I refer to them as pain points.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell somebody to not use a mix template when a mix template is actually addressing their biggest pain point. And that's going to be the thing that is the difference between an okay mix and a great mix.
Yeah.
Like, great. Just spend a day, mix a song. If you don't already know this, I think most people who have spent any time mixing probably have a good idea of what their pain points are or friction, but write it down. Grab a pad of paper and start mixing a song. And the minute you start second guessing or triple guessing something, write that down and then fix it and move on and be like, and I bet you, if you did this for two or three or four mixes, you'd start seeing common themes. You'd be like, you know what? I've adjusted the snare level 16 times because I'm second guessing. Is it too loud? Is it not loud enough? Is it too bright? Is it not like, so, okay, cool. There, you have a tendency. There's something to do with snare drums and the levels and the brightness and whatever. Yeah. That's a thing for you. So figure out a workflow, figure out a brain hack, figure out a way to use the technology so that way you can take some of that second guessing out when you're in the heat of the moment. But don't figure that out while you're in the heat of the moment. Schedule some time to do it. But I think a lot of people, again, it's like bad sports analogies. I mean, if you don't, I love golf. I'm a huge golf nut. And like knowing, like when you, I don't have a lot of time to play and practice anymore. So it's kind of like, if I hit my irons pretty well already when I'm out on the course, when I'm practicing, that's probably not the thing I should be practicing if I, you know, can't sink a putt.
Yeah.
But it's really easy when we're talking about sports, or we're talking about, well, sports is a really easy one. I don't know, the rest of life maybe is not so easy, but it's really easy to identify what you need to work on.
Yeah.
In mixing, there hasn't been a lot of kind of, I don't know, education or encouragement to address it like, okay, what are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? I think most people don't know. And not only about like, what do people like about your mixes and what people don't like about your mixes, but like, what is easy for you to achieve when you're mixing, and what's not so easy for you to do? Like for me, like vocals, lead vocals. There's so many variables with lead vocals. That's the thing I find myself just getting in analysis paralysis like crazy. Like I used to joke, I'm like, if I could get hired just to mix instrumentals, I'm like, I would feel like a god. Yeah. But the minute you start putting vocals in, everything goes to shit. No, but it's like, so I spend the majority of my time experimenting when I'm not mixing. And if I'm playing around with stuff, I'm spending the majority of my time like really being like, okay, do I like parallel compression with lead vocals? Do I not? What everybody's using Soothe now. Is that something that I need to do or is it not? You know, that last vocal, I ended up having to like crank so much top end in order to get it to sit where I wanted to do. Is that something that's going to be a common thing? Let's try that on 5 different sessions and see. Or was that a one-off? So that way next time when I'm in the heat of it and I'm like having a problem with the vocal being like, oh yeah, you know what? I'm going to try cranking just a ton of top end and see. And be like, no, that was a one-time, one-trick pony. That's not going to happen every time. But you got to, in order to fix a problem, you have to identify the problem. And I think mixing has become just such a like cross your fingers, hope and pray and start slapping on plugins and hoping one of them fixes your problem and start moving faders around and start just throwing shit at the wall and see what sticks. And again, that used to work. I used to do that and it used to work like, you know, 1 out of 10 times. And until I started really being like, okay, what's the problem? And once I've identified what the issues are, then I can kind of figure out, well, okay, what's my training, regimen to get better at those weaknesses?
Yeah, it's true. And I think that, like you said, from my point of view, you know, you need more at bats to take the sports.
Yeah, I love it.
you need to practice, and ultimately, yeah, again, when the pressure's on, it's one of those things that's great. But spending that time away from those pressured environments, but like, look, I really need to focus on. I've got my list of things here. From my point of view, you know, it's always vocals. From my point of view, I think it's for everyone. Well, one of the biggest points. It's not.
It's so hard.
It feels it just thrown on top. It really is, especially, you know, I think I had one session I'd done a few months ago and there was like 90 tracks of vocals, you know, and they're all harmonies, counter harmonies, like group gangs. And you're like, right, I've got to sum this down somehow. I've got to bounce these things around. And that was actually quite a nice feeling of being like, I'm going to commit these. I'm going to commit them. And once they're committed, that's it. And then I'm like, oh, there was this weight came off my shoulders as soon as I committed a few of those. Like, right. I'm good. Now I can move on, because you can sit there, and especially vocal comping as well and all of these things. But like you said, actually spending that time, I think is probably the biggest thing I've learned. So I'm glad that was also a point from your point of view, is like looking at your weaknesses, those pain points, I think are key, because like you said, you can lose a lot of hair, you know, by pulling it out, by just sit there at the same time, but I've got the same issue again, that snare drum or that sample. So like you said, it's key, but from your point of view as well, randomly, how's the move to Nashville been?
So far, so good. I'm loving the city. I'm loving just the music community here is unlike anywhere else. And you know, I lived in LA for almost 20 years, and I loved LA too. Like me and my wife both. You know, it was a hard decision to make. We were up in Vancouver for a few years, and it was like. Yeah. Nashville kind of like checked all the boxes, but our heartstrings were being tugged to go back to the sunny skies of California. And so knowing that we're kind of, like I said, we're, you know, just craving going back to LA, there was always a little bit of a question mark of like, is this going to fulfill kind of that feeling? And it's been so awesome. No, even little ounces of regret so far. And, I mean, we're still getting settled and I'm still kind of getting acclimated. And, it's interesting. I did have somebody recently being like, so what new Nashville projects you were working on? I'm like, to be honest with you, I've been so busy just doing like the stuff that, I mean, I could be doing it from anywhere, but like, I haven't done like any Nashville stuff
I've
yet.
I've got jelly rolled and I've then got.
Yeah, exactly.
like it's, you're just going to walk through the door there. And I think it's, but I just said it's the environment with Nashville. It's the only really reason why I asked, because I've, it's something that, especially recently, I've been wanting to really go back to just as a, just to see it again. Cause I think it's a great place to go to, and it's country music as well. It's not just country music. I mean, there's a band I've been listening to recently called a band called Lakeview.
I know those guys.
Yeah, well, oh, you do.
Love those
Amazing.
Guys. Yeah.
Incredible guys. And their music's really well, really translated over here in the UK. But I was listening to that, I was like, this is great. It's like, where are these guys from? Nashville. I was like, where's this hard rock metal country thing came from? But yeah, those guys are great. Yeah, again, that's an amazing sounding album. That album sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it's really hard hitting, but good song. Yeah. Like it's so cool.
It's great. And I think, again, when you said you made the move there, I was like, do you know what? That seems like a real cool place, because people are moving out to Austin. It's great for music and comedy as well. And I think, again, being positioned there is fantastic. So, look, Chris, I'll let you go. We've had you here for a while. You mentioned as well a little while ago, and I don't know if you want to plug it, a shameless plug, but do you have a masterclass of some sorts coming up soon, or a kind of something you may want people to have a look at?
I do, absolutely. It's not out yet. We're kind of putting the final touches on the editing and everything. But if you go to my website, which is just chrisbasefor.com, or if you follow me on Instagram, or YouTube, I'll be letting everybody know when it's available. But it was actually, if I can take 2 seconds, just kind of talk about it a little bit. The concept was to, obviously there's lots of existing kind of mixed with the masters and stuff like that, which are awesome. And I watch a lot of those as well. But the thing that I wanted to do was provide a little bit of the experience that I got coming up in a professional studio, where it wasn't necessarily about, sitting down and getting a lesson from the engineer who's been in the business for 30 years. It was being a fly on the wall in real world situations.
Yeah.
And so the concept behind the yet to be named production course was to basically do a real world session with a band, and make it as real life as possible, which it was, and provide everybody the fly on the wall experience with the added benefit of, yes, there is, I did explain things in detail, and I did have a select group of people there live while we were recording the band. And so their questions were a lot of the time what probably all the viewers were going to ask anyways. And so, it's a really, I hope it's going to be a really educational and unique experience for people who go through the course and watch it, because it is a lot of footage of being just witness to a real life professional session. Yeah. And all the good that comes with it and all the bad that comes with it is all there for everybody to see and hopefully learn from. So we've got, I think we've probably got about another month of kind of final touches, and then we'll be releasing that. So,
we'll keep an eye out.
Yeah. If you're not already, subscribed to my newsletter, if you go to my website and subscribe to that, you'll get notifications when it's kind of ready. So.
Yeah, and being an active subscriber, I definitely would recommend that, because there's a lot of hints and tips, a lot of live Q&As. So, Chris, you're an absolute superstar for coming on.
Oh my goodness, thank you.
An advocate for the industry, as well, which I think is key. No ego, which I think is brilliant. Just someone who's just in it.
So sure.
I say that. It's come out the last minute. It's literally now come out.
Yeah,
but Chris, it's been a pleasure. Hopefully next time I'm over the US, it'd be great to catch up for a
that
coffee.
That would be amazing.
It'd be brilliant. And we'll let you go. But thank you again.
Thank you. Appreciate it.